I'm Brittany French.
Hey, I'm Rob McDonald.
And this is the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast.
We're going to talk about everything from fishing and hunting to hiking, paddling, and adventures on the Great Plains. We'll cover it all here.
So join us each episode and hear what's going on in the great outdoors on the Great Plains. Hey y'all, welcome to another episode on the Great Plains Outdoors Podcast. I just got back from the beautiful mountains of Colorado, where I did some hiking with my husband and a couple of our friends. And I got to say, that crisp mountain air got me really excited for the fall season. I was a little disappointed to come back to Kansas and it was still in the upper 90s. But with that being said, we are just 10 days away from what many of us consider the start of hunting season. Rob, how do you feel about the upcoming dove season?
You know, I am ready for fall and all things autumn, dove season included. In fact, recently wrote an article that you can go check out over at thegreatplainsoutdoors.com. And that article is based around how September is this gateway month to so many outdoor, primarily hunting activities. From waterfowl with early teal and upland with grouse and sharpies, prairie chickens, and you know, the small game really gets going. The squirrels will be going crazy here, and big game season start to open up with muzzleloader for deer, and guys are getting after elk this time of year in September. Antelope season comes open, so they're across the Great Plains, there is so much to try and keep track of, whether you're hunting in the Dakotas or Nebraska, into Kansas. So go check out that article. But yeah, I am pretty stoked for the month of September.
Yeah, September is like the back to school month for teachers, but for hunters.
It's pretty great.
Today, we're going to be highlighting a really unique wildlife area here in Kansas that's very much in line with the month of September. Kansas is home to the nearly 20,000 acre Cheyenne Bottoms Wildlife Area and is part of a 41,000 acre natural land sink just northeast of Great Bend, Kansas. Many of you have probably heard of it. Many of you have probably been to it, and many of you want to go to it. Cheyenne Bottoms is the largest inland marsh in the United States, packed smack dab in the middle of the central flyway, and is famous for its waterfowl hunting opportunities. I think Rob and I have both had the opportunity to hunt out there, and I think we can say, yep, that's pretty true. We're lucky enough to have Jason Wagner, the area manager for Cheyenne Bottoms, joining us today to talk about the famous wetlands, waterfowl hunting, and his experiences with managing the incredibly popular wetland area. But first, we're going to get to know Jason a little better. Jason grew up in Otis, Kansas, where he fell in love with the outdoors, specifically hunting, fishing, and trapping. He graduated from Otis Bison High School in 2001 and then attended Fort Hays State University, where he graduated in 2005 with a BS degree in biology with an emphasis in wildlife and fisheries. After college, he worked for the Texas Parks and Wildlife Department, where he worked on public lands in the desert mountains of West Texas. He changed positions and became a district biologist and ultimately the lead biologist for the Trans-Pecos District of Texas Parks and Wildlife. He spent a total of 8 years down south working with a unique ecosystem with some incredible wildlife like desert bighorn sheep, desert mule deer, pronghorn, elk, scaled quail, and mountain lions, just to name a few. While down there, he was working a full-time, he attended Sol Ra State University and got a master's degree in natural resource management. In 2013, the opportunity presented itself to hire on with the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks out of Hays as an area biologist. He stayed in that position for 3.5 years when the public land manager for Cheyenne Bottoms came open. Jason says he got lucky when he was offered the job and started in 2017. Jason lives in a small hobby farm out by Otis with his wife, Julie, daughters, Jaylee and Kinsley. He is passionate about outdoors and he enjoys spending the time outdoors with his family and friends. Jason, thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to talk to you about all things Cheyenne Bottoms, but first, you know, tell us a little bit about yourself and, you know, what you're excited for this fall.
Well, thank you for having me today and opportunity to talk with your listeners about Cheyenne Bottoms and maybe current conditions and past conditions and everything like that, and a little bit about myself. So thanks for the kind introduction as well. like I said, the introduction was pretty good. I grew up in Otis, which people that may not know, that's only 20 miles away from here. So I grew up hunting the bottoms as a kid. My parents both hunted out here. Both my grandparents, my grandpa's hunted out here. And my grandpa was probably one of the first people that hunted out here back in the 50s when Cheyenne Bottoms first opened up to the public for hunting. So this place is in my blood. I'm the luckiest man alive to be able to get a job managing this incredible place, and it's a place I truly enjoy, and it's been part of my past, and it instilled my love for hunting in the outdoors out here. So it was a big influencer when I was growing up, and I never thought when I started down a career path that I would actually end up being the manager out here. So like I said, it's just a place that I love. Every day's a good day out here. You don't have too many bad days out of Cheyenne Bottoms. There's some days that are better than others, but when you're working out here, it's always a good day. You can always find something to be happy about. So
yeah, that's awesome. It sounds like lucky is probably the right term then that you used when you landed that job out there.
Yeah. A lot of hard work in the past too, but like I said, I was very fortunate on this opportunity. So,
well, thank you for managing such a beautiful chunk of public land for the rest of us here in Kansas and, you know, outsiders too. It's not an easy job. And so we're thankful for folks like you who are in the position to steward your passion well, to make the land better for the rest of us.
Thank you. You know, you brought into what I'm excited about for the fall. Unfortunately, we were talking before the started recording about the drought kind of conditions that we're in. Mm-hmm. And it is unfortunate that we are in a dry cycle right now in Western Kansas here. It's been a very abnormally hot, dry conditions. We've had very little rainfall. Very little runoff. Unfortunately, it's looking like, at least at the early part of the season, it's going to be a dry year where there's no water available out here for hunting opportunities. But it's not all doom and gloom. With that being said, we're able to get out in the pools. We're able to get out and do work that we hadn't been able to do. Last time it was this dry was in 2012, 2013. So we're able to get out and do some work that needs to be done. It's well past due for getting done. So we've had that opportunity to get out and improve the wildlife area a lot. So yeah. Like I said, unfortunately for waterfowl, it may not be the best conditions this year, but you know, there's other opportunities out here that seems like our upland game birds, specifically the pheasants population, seems to be slightly up this year, at least on the wildlife area where dry wetlands make really good pheasant habitat. So there's always plus sides. So, but like I said, the main plus side is being able to get out and do some work in the pools.
Yeah, absolutely. You gotta try to find the beauty in the storm, right? Or the non-storm in this situation, since we can't get any.
Yeah, and we've been going through a $6 million Pittman Robertson Act grant over the last several years. And part of the issue with the lack of water, there's one way that we get water onto the property, and they're working on that one way right now. And with everything happening, it's a little bit behind schedule. Timing was still good though. It was dry, so they were able to, since it is dry, they're able to continue the work. Working in a wetland environment is never easy, especially when you're doing a lot of construction and actually pouring concrete and stuff within the wetland itself. Doing some of that work, I was surprised as went as smoothly as it did. The weather did cooperate with them, so it didn't prolong the work that's been being done out here still.
So Jason, before we get too far, let's back up a little bit. And you know, you and I and Brittany, we all understand wetland areas and marshlands and have been to Cheyenne Bottoms, right? But maybe for some of our listeners that aren't familiar, you know, let's talk a little bit about the importance of Cheyenne Bottoms, you know, its geography. You know, obviously these migratory birds are coming south out of their nesting grounds, whether that's up into Canada, the Dakotas, right? You're primarily, I'm guessing most of the birds that are coming down are in the Central Flyway.
Yes.
Your stopover point. So, you know, let's just talk a little bit about what that looks like. You know, how many birds do you typically see? How many acres of water? You know, obviously this is a dry year. When do the birds show up? That type of thing for, you know, maybe listeners that either aren't familiar with it, maybe they're big game hunters or upland hunters aren't really familiar with waterfowl or the area.
Okay. Yeah. So as far as wetland acres go on the property, we have approximately 13,000 acres of wetlands. So our property is just, we purchased another piece. So we're just under 20,000 acres. We're like 19,998, and about 13,000 acres of those are under normal circumstances are wet. So that's a pretty good chunk of wetland in one area. There's nothing else like it in the United States, biggest inland marsh, but even just on our wildlife area, but not including what's on the Nature Conservancy property. That's a huge chunk of wetland in one small area.
Now, when you say wetland, you know, I've been there and I've hunted marshes before, but you know, what's like the average depth in those pools?
We try to get so we have the storage pools in the inside of the property that allows us to store up water.
Okay.
And those we can get up to 6 feet deep. But typically, we wouldn't consider that an ideal wetland conditions. Normally, on the perimeter pools, which are normal where most people hunt, we try to get it about 18 inches. We would consider that to be a full pool. And you know, it's not 18 inches across the whole place. It's 18 inches at the end at certain spots within the pool that we consider the historical elevation, and it tapers off toward the perimeter of those pools.
Okay. Now, are those pools wet year round? I mean, is there 18 inches of water in there in a typical wet year? Are you guys out there, you know, keeping those pools semi-dried where you can do plantings, mow? You know, what does that look? You know, if I show up, am I just going to look out across like a lagoon of just 18 inches or of surface water that's 18 inches deep or deeper? You know, I know the answer. There's mixed in plants and all kinds of stuff going on there, but how do you accomplish that?
What our ideal situation that we have we'll have 18 inches of water. We'll like to have it starting about this time of the year. We usually start flooding those perimeter pools, and then we'll flood them for the fall hunting season, and we'll leave some of those pools wet until May to allow for the spring migration as well. Because I mean, that's something else we got to take in consideration. Yeah, we're focused on hunting and stuff this time of the year, but we got to take in account getting those birds, not only the ducks, but also ducks, geese, and then shorebirds as well. We got to take into consideration on their northward migration, get them back to the north. The better condition they are getting up north, the more eggs they'll lay, and the better the hatch will be, right? So,
sure.
But our typical scenario is we try to flood at this time of the year. We'll leave that 18 inches of water on until about January or February. When the ice starts melting a little bit, we'll start dewatering those pools. And it's in a place this big, it's a very slow process. We're talking weeks, months to dewater those pools. So then we like to have those, at least some of them dry by say early May to allow them to dry out. And those are the pools that we're going to target for doing certain work out here, specifically cattail and Phragmites control. Mm-hmm. So then we'll have those dry, and we like to leave them dry May, June, July, August, and then we'll repeat that cycle every year. We don't always have all the pools dry all at once. Normally we try to stage it around a little bit to allow for varying habitat conditions throughout the whole property to accommodate the wide variety of birds that use out here. Like I said, it's not just the ducks and geese that, even though those are kind of my main priority for management, we also got to take in consideration the other species of birds that utilize the property. So we always try to vary very little bit, and where the water is and where we do water just depends on what pools we're looking at targeting for that cattail control. So that's our main, a lot of what we do is focused on cattail control, trying to do water. And if we could get to pull the water off, we can keep the cattails out of there. And we keep the cattails out of there, it's better wetland conditions where we have the moist soil plants, the annual moist soil plants like smartweed, barnyard grass. Those are two main waterfowl foods. Try to get those to regrow. So we'll let the water off, let them establish throughout the summer, produce seed, then we'll flood it for the birds in the fall.
So that was my next question is, in those dry months, you know, you let the water off. So in June, July, maybe, or are you guys seeding things like smartweed or millet or barnyard grass? Or is that something that those were planted at one point and they just volunteered back? Or, you know, what does that look like?
We try to vary a little bit. We will plant in areas that we've done the cattail control, which we run the disc through, and we disc it, multiple diskings. That kind of ends up just being like a farm field. So then those are the areas that we'll go back through and try to plant millet and produce. And a lot of the areas on the timing of our dewatering will constitute what plants we'll come back with. We're going to have smartweed, the broadleaf annual plants, or some of the grasses such as barnyard grass and the wild millets and stuff come back in. So we try to vary it as much as possible. We don't plant any corn or anything like that. Japanese millet is our main one. We've planted Milo in the past in some of the pools as well, but what returns after a disking, after cattail control, a lot of those moist soil plants that are duck food is their native, and we don't usually have to do much as far. We try to let some of that return, and then we'll go through the pools as well, and if there's areas that the moist soil plant production wasn't very good, we could disc them up a little bit or overseed some of that with Japanese millet. It's kind of our go-to plant. We can't a lot of the smaller wetlands, they could really control their water levels. We don't have much control over a lot of our water levels in some of our pools, so if we get a big rain, if we're planting some of our normal crops like corn or Milo, something like that, it flood out pretty easily. But if the Japanese millet gives us a better opportunity to survive under a wider range of circumstances. So that's our go-to plan out here that we'll plant. So,
gotcha. So, and I've kind of wondered about this. I've been out there before hunting, and you know, smart weeds up or millet, or maybe there's some fireweed and some tumbleweeds and stuff that have grown over the summer. And you look out across a pool. And for our listeners, right, it's broken up, the property's broken up into multiple pools that have retention dikes around them, and then you guys have gates where you can let water in and out, but there are pathways, I guess, maybe is the right word, where you guys just go in there with like a bush hog behind a tractor before you flood and kind of mow those areas out so hunters have access, and then there's open pool areas mixed into the cover for the birds. Is that how that works?
Yeah. So it varies depending on the pool too, but yeah, we try to, sometimes it depends on how thick and tall the vegetation is. We could go through and mow some of that, with some of our specialized equipment. Even if there's water on there, we have it's called a Marsh Master. It's basically a floating skid steer. It has pontoons and tracks on it. So we go about anywhere in the marsh with that. But a lot of times I like to let it just be native. I mean, there's areas that grow up tall. There's areas that don't grow any vegetation because of the alkali soil that we have out here. So it varies throughout the pool. And I'm more of a little bit of a hands off on that aspect. Sometimes we will hunter access stuff we'll do. And then we go through, and during the summer months, we'll also spray out a lot of the boating channels or access points, so then people can get around to the pools a little bit better. But after a while, if you get enough birds on there and enough hunter activity, it creates those little pockets and stuff in there too, and the channels and access points as well. So the area is so big. I mean, you know, we do a lot to promote it, and then I like I said, mowing it. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't, but we try to spray and keep some channels open and stuff for access.
Jason, I'm curious, on a good year at the bottoms, you know, where there's not a drought, what does it look like on a daily basis, or like maybe opening weekend? How many people, how many hunters are out there?
A couple years ago, 2 years ago, 2019, 2020, we were really busy. 2020, the opening day of teal season, there was upwards of 850 people out here on opening day of teal season.
Wow.
Conditions were right. We did, that was one of those that we did a lot of work in a couple areas, well, we had a lot of millet planted. The habitat conditions were great. We had some summer rain that allowed our moist soil to produce really good. And, you know, we probably had over 100,000 teal out here on opening day. And like I said, everybody, I think the average that day was just shy of a limit. You know, it was like 5.6 ducks per hunter, you know, 850 hunters. That's pretty good. So, and it dwindles off throughout the season. You know, opening weeks are always really busy. And then it always seems like opening or the first week of November, we kind of have an uptick on our hunting pressure and stuff. And it seems like our pressure has been a little bit more consistent. When I first started hunting out here, growing out here, you'd show up on a Wednesday and you may be one of two trucks out here, you know, on a Wednesday afternoon. We'd always, you know, I went to college at Fort Hays, so in the afternoons, after we'd get out of class, we'd come down here a lot and hunt. And there was hardly anybody out here. Now it's a little bit different scenario. You know, word's gotten out. It does receive a little bit, seem like a little bit more consistent pressure than it used to. So,
yeah.
But there's still times where there's not, you can still have the place to yourself, or not to yourself, but relatively low pressure and stuff. So there's plenty of, if I get it cleaned up, you know, I've talked about the cattail control we've done. What has happened is the cattails decrease usable space by not only for hunters, but mostly for the birds. So as we continue to work on the cattails and get the cattails under control, the amount of huntable acres will continue to increase on the property. And that's pretty key to me on that. And what we've done also with the cattail control, you know, some people are complaining they like the cattails because it allows hunters to hide. Historically, there was blinds out here every 300 yards. So as we're getting these pools cleaned up, we're trying to make an effort to reestablish those blind islands. There used to be an island around the concrete bunkers that are out here that you guys have probably seen in the water. There used to be an island around every one of those. And it used to be a draw system where people would have to come in and check into each one of those blinds out here. But that's no longer the case. But what we're trying to do is build those islands back up. So there's places for hunters to get out of the water. There's good cover on those islands for hunters to hide, and it also helps space the hunters out. So that gives, you know, hunters 300 yards between another group of hunters. Whereas when all the cattails were here, it seems like people were getting a little congested a little bit. So it's multiple reasons, and also it provides good nesting habitat for birds within the pools. So
very good. One thing I love that Kansas has is, you know, the special youth and veteran season. And Jason, mm-hmm. we've worked with you with Pass It On Outdoor Mentors and over there at the Kansas Wetland Education Center to get kids outfitted with waders and take advantage of that weekend. We talk a little bit about that and how veterans and kids get a little premium access here in Kansas, yes. The Bottoms.
Yeah, so we also, you know, the youth and veterans military weekend is always before. It's usually right between teal season and the regular duck season. So the birds have a week off to kind of rest, get reaccumulated in the pools, and then we allow the youth to go in the military to have that weekend to themselves. And what we've done out here in the Bottoms to help with the pressure, we give the kids one pool in particular that is just for the youth only, and then the rest of the property is open to anybody. We also have a youth mentor area behind the Wetland Education Center that the youth can go to. You guys have been putting on a Hunt Through the Youth Outdoor Mentors program where it's usually been Ducks Unlimited volunteers and stuff come out and take kids out. I allow them in pool five, so they have which is typically a refuge, so it's off limits to most people, and get kids out there to have a good quality hunt. Aside from that, we normally also have a special hunt through the Kansas, through wildlife and parks. Every Saturday of regular duck season, I allow a group of three kids. It's through the special hunt draw. One kid gets drawn and he can select up to two additional kids to go with him. And they have until 11 o'clock in the morning every Saturday of regular duck season to allow for, again, a special hunt opportunity, a good quality hunt for the kids. And we're actually, you know, that's in pool five, so that's a refuge. And it's been well received. Some of the kids have had really good quality hunts in there. And we're actually working on reestablishing one of our old wetlands, making it functional again, where it's going to be just for youth, 110 acre wetland that we're redoing and put a peninsula out there and a good blind where people can drive through and get good access to, and again for the quality hunt for kids. So that'll be through special hunts. It's still in the works, but it's getting closer to being started on that one. So
Jason, you mentioned you're talking about those special hunts and that pool five, and you mentioned a preserve area. So, you know, for our listeners that maybe aren't familiar with the bottoms, so there's areas that you can hunt. There's areas that are off limits to hunting, the birds have access to. And then I don't know how far it is. I'm sure you do. So the Quivira wetland area is, I don't know, some number of miles over from you. And that's strictly no hunting, I think. And then if there's a network of roads around the bottoms, parking areas. So if somebody was going to come out and try and hunt, obviously, if you don't have water this year, don't make the trip. Watch the forecast and call first to see if, or check the website. But I guess maybe talk a little bit about how that's broken up into, you know, how many pools, what the road access looks like, if you're a handicap hunter, and then, you know, the areas that, you know, you're not allowed to hunt in, you know, make sure people understand that it's not just free for all, hunt wherever you want.
Right. So, one thing I wanted to point out real quick, Quivira does offer hunting. They have some walk-in hunting access and stuff, and it's about 40 miles away from here. So there is some hunting opportunities down at Quivira. They closed some of their property due to whooping cranes. So a lot of times they are closed when the presence of whooping cranes, but there are some that are available. So what I'm referring to, Pool 5 is kind of our moist soil unit for that's part of the refuge. So typically that's closed off. So on those special hunts, we allow kids to go in there into the refuge and hunt. We have several hunting pools. So pool five is closed to hunting, and then our center pools, which are our water storage pools, those are also closed to all activities. But other than that, we have pool two, which is no restrictions at all. We have a pool 3A that's open to, it's closed to motorized boats. So it's open to walk in, you could row in and stuff. And that's again, to kind of alleviate some of the pressure. 3B is wide open. And you can go in there, access any way you want to. Pool 4A is a pool that this last year was the first year we tried it, and we ended up having whooping cranes stay in there throughout most of the season, so we weren't able to really see the effects of it. We had a new regulation there where it's closed to motorized boats after 1 p.m. So they could be in there and hunt with boats in the morning, and then it gave the birds a little bit of a rest period without any boat activity in the afternoons. And then pool 4B is also open to all activity. I mean, it's open and it's wide open. And these pools range anywhere from 672 acres up to our biggest pool is 3,200 acres. So, and they're divided. So we have access points, we have boat ramps all over the place. We've gone through for drainage issues. We've dug out a lot of our ditches. So we have access points for foot crossings where they're either like little bridges or their culverts over the ditch, so people can access in and out of there as well. We have parking areas throughout the whole property, but a lot of people will also just park along the side of the road. Please pull off the side of the road. They can park along the side of the road and walk or row out wherever they want to hunt, which are close access points and stuff. So
run that by me again. You said 600, how many acres were some of the smaller pools?
The smallest pool we have is pool 4B. It's 672 acres.
Okay. And so for our listeners, maybe that aren't familiar, a mile section, right? A mile by a mile is 640 acres. Yeah. So just give a little perspective of how large the smallest pool is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's larger than a square mile.
And a lot of the other wetland managers, they always tell me, they go, you know, our whole wetland acres wall fit in one of your biggest pools. So we're pretty significant size, and which, like I said, we vary everything on management. You know, like I said, some of the restrictions that we put on place the last couple of years, the 1 and 4B, 4A, where the closes to motorized boats at 1 p.m. and then the close to all motorized boats 3A. It's just been to try to eliminate a little bit of a pressure that we've been having the last few years. So
sure, and that's probably
and like I said, they're all managed a little bit different. They provide different habitat types. Certain pools grow better moist soil plants than others. Pool two has been a real problematic pool for us. It's been pretty much been able to get taken over by cattails the last few years. We don't have any control of water coming into pool two. So there's two creeks that end up in pool two, and a rain off the property, even 10 miles away, a big rain, and then pool two will fill up sometimes overnight. So it's hard to manage a lot of acres, and it's hard to pull that water off to get cattails under control. And that's actually where we're disking in right now to try to start killing off some of those cattails too. So
you mentioned some access restrictions, particularly with boating, to help ease some pressure. And I'm guessing that's probably both pressure on for hunters, for people trying to get in there and set up. I mean, not everybody has a boat, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And then probably pressure on the birds.
That's, you know, we got to give the birds, and that's why we have such an intricate refuge system here. I mean, if you got to give the birds time to rest, places to rest, time to rest, give them spots within those hunting pools to rest. What we've noticed the last couple of years or last few years is the birds have really turned nocturnal. So you could get in there, you know, you're sitting there out in the pool at 5 o'clock in the morning, there's just ducks everywhere. And then all of a sudden, 45 minutes before shooting light, there's this huge mass exodus of the pools, and they all leave and they fly to the refuge. And then they sit in the refuge all day. And then as you're walking out or leaving for work in the evening, you know, the sun sets, and then all the birds fly into the hunting pools where all the food is located at. Uh-huh. And one other access restriction that I failed to mention, with the new technology and a lot of boating stuff, we've gone to a no wake speed throughout the whole property. All boats must be operated no wake speed. When you got like opening day of teal season, like I said, a couple of years ago, there was 850 people out here. You know, out of every parking lot that we have a boat ramp on, there'd be 40 to 50 trucks. You have that many boating activity, that many people out in the marsh, and lots of cattails. It was becoming a real safety concern that we were, that was one thing. And then again, some of the disturbance within the pools to the ducks. And then, you know, it's almost becoming a joyriding. You know, you see the jet skis out in the lake during summer. Some of the people were becoming a joyriding deal where people were getting in their mud boats and just seeing how fast they could go across the pools and stuff like that. So, to prevent that disturbance and activities, we decided that we'd go through a no wake zone, and it really cut back on that those activities, and it seemed like the ducks were utilizing the pools a little bit more readily too. So
gotcha. So the area is dry. Looks like it's not going to be a very good season for migratory birds. I mean, cross your fingers, hope for rain, right? But you mentioned some upland opportunity, you know, other hunting opportunity there. I don't, you know, I've never gone to the bottoms to hunt anything except for waterfowl. So, you know, here's this huge public property, plenty of access. You want to speak just a little bit if folks are looking for, I don't know if there's big game opportunity, if it's mostly upland, or, you know, what else is available on the property?
Well, we're still, I mean, yeah, we our primary focus is waterfowl, but we do a lot of management for upland game birds, specifically pheasants on the property. Quail is a little bit limited just because of the habitat that we have out here, but we do plant a lot of wheat under our uplands. We let it go. We do a lot of prescribed burning, trying to tailor as much of our management practices we have time for for pheasants. We do a lot of disking. Sometimes we just disk food plots and let them go go into sunflowers. We have anywhere from a couple, usually about 200 to 400 acres of uncut wheat on the property that we plant ourselves. We let it grow. You know, it provides food for waterfowl, specifically geese. And then we let it go, and that provides good pheasant habitat as well. The last few years, 2019, we had a really high water. The whole, pretty much all of the property was completely flooded. And that really kind of hurt our pheasant population. You know, there was no nesting. It displaced all of the adult pheasants that we had on the property. So it's taken a few years for us to rebound. But like I said, these dry wetland conditions really are good pheasant habitat. And I've noticed a little bit of an increase in pheasant numbers this year. And again, that's something that we still emphasize. And we still, you know, we offer, people can come out here and deer hunt. It's not an overly popular activity. It's really hard hunting. Deer, even when it's wet, they like to go out in the cattails, and they can hide on those cattails really well. So it's pretty tough hunting. Generally, our deer densities are a little bit lower than some of the wooded habitat. You know, we don't have hardly any trees on the property at all. So it's a little bit different style hunting than most deer hunting than most people are accustomed to. So good rabbit opportunity, you know, small game. The rabbits are pretty plentiful out here as well. So,
gotcha. So as far as the access, let's say, you know, I'm coming from wherever, we're going to make a trip to come out and try and bring my Labrador and hunt upland or, mm-hmm. or my pointer for that matter, whatever, my bird dog. What is, you know, so Great Bend is right there, you know, hotels, restaurants, whatever. I don't think, and you speak to this, so I don't think there's camping access. I mean, don't pull out there thinking you're going to pitch a tent and have a campfire, that kind of thing. Or maybe I'm wrong.
No, we do have a campground that's open and it's free to the public. It's awesome. Come and go as you please. There's no reservations. It's just to the west here of our headquarters on the west side. It's a half mile to the west of headquarters here. And actually, in the last year, we've done quite a bit of significant improvements out there. We've included a vault. We added a vault toilet to there. We've expanded the campground because during the heavy use during waterfowl seasons, there wasn't a place you couldn't park another truck out there down the campground. People were trying to camp on the sides of the roads down there by the campground. At one point, we allowed them to camp in front of the headquarters here too. So we've expanded on that. We're trying to make it a little bit nicer facility for people to utilize. So they can use that. But like I said, local amenities, Poise 10, Great Bend, just a few miles, you know, 5 miles away, easy drive. There's RV camping and stuff in there. At our campground, it's completely primitive. There's no water or electricity. So, but you're more than welcome to come use it. People use it year round. The last few years, we've noticed a big uptick in the number of people that the camp there during the off season. So, you know, bird watchers come here and utilize it as well. So,
very cool.
That's great. I love hearing about all of the details that go into managing the wetlands. I think people probably see Cheyenne Bottoms as this like wonderful place to go, and it is, but you're like, let me tell you about what it looks like to make it this wonderful. And I'm sure you have a pretty good staff too of folks in the department to help you, you know, kind of manage and do the legwork on all of this too.
We have three full-time staff out here, myself, and then we have general maintenance technician Gene Schneewise, and then Kim Schneewise is our equipment operator. And then we usually hire a couple college age students during the summer months to help us out as well. You know, this time of year, or when the conditions are like this, we could probably use three or four times the amount of staff that we have right now in equipment. Just we're dry. There's, like I said, there's stuff we haven't been able to do, places we hadn't been able to go in 10 plus years. We're able to do it this year. So we've been extremely, extremely busy throughout this dry period of time. So,
yeah. Yeah. I want to go back just briefly. You mentioned your grandpa was mm-hmm. like one of the first ones to hunt out at Cheyenne Bottoms. Is that what I heard correctly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Give me a time frame on that.
So the Bottoms, the dedication ceremony was in 1957. the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks started purchasing the land that now makes up Cheyenne Bottoms in 1942. It was one of the first, the way that the Kansas first started spending their Pittman-Robertson Act money was in 1942. They started buying the land that now makes up Cheyenne Bottoms. So, and then, like I said, it was completed in 1957. So
that's incredible.
Been a while. Then some of the structures that they put in place in the 50s, we're still using them today. And some of them were, this big grant that we're going through right now, replacing or repairing some of that stuff. But a lot of the stuff that was put in place in the 50s is still functioning and still usable today. So
how long is this current grant that you guys are receiving? What's the time frame on that?
We're getting close to completion. The last project is the installation of this new pump station that we'll be able to, like I mentioned earlier, that pump pool two is, we hadn't been able to dewater and it's real problematic. We're putting in a new pump station that will allow us to quicker dewater pool two to better manage pool two and that kind of prevent some of the cattail problems that we've had there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I know we've talked about PR dollars, you know, on this podcast a few different times, but I'm curious to see, have you explain it from a department angle? How did you guys get awarded a PR grant as in conjunction, you know, with the department, being a part of the department? What did you guys do to get that? And then kind of just elaborate, these funds are from what?
Okay. So we just basically, we had to put in through the feds, it's the Pittman-Robertson Act is excise tax on guns, ammunition, and sporting goods, certain sporting goods. That money is collected by the federal government and distributed to the states based on hunting license sales and population size, that type of stuff. So that money is then we get for every dollar that we contribute, and that comes from our hunting license or stamp money, state waterfowl stamp, not federal waterfowl stamp, state waterfowl stamp, hunting license and permit sales. For every dollar we contribute, then $3 from that Pittman-Robertson Act also gets contributed for a total of $4. So we had to put in an application. And again, that it has to benefit, those grants are benefiting wildlife restoration. And it usually has some kind of, you know, we're trying to, out here, we're trying to promote for hunting access, the other part of it, but mostly wildlife habitat is the main focus on that grant. So we put in for that back in 2018. And we're getting really close to wrapping up that total spell. You know, it takes a while to get everything bid out, and you know, the last couple of years with supply issues and workforce issues within some of those contractors, it's taken a little bit longer than expected. And of course, the price increase on everything didn't help anything. But we're still able to get most of the projects done that we wanted to. So we're getting close to wrapping that up. So.
Turns out even wildlife is not immune to inflation.
Yeah.
That's a great way to hear about how the department's stewarding PR dollars. And I think other people would agree with that as well. So that's really cool to hear about that project. Well, I think, Jason, if you're up for it, we're going to do a lightning round. This is where people usually get a little squirmy, like, oh no, what do I expect? Kind of like what Rob talked about earlier today, just a this or that, low pressure. We're just trying to get to know you a little better, and we'll see how you turn out in the end. All right. So here's your first one. Are you more excited to hunt in Kansas or Texas?
Oh, Kansas by far.
I figured
yeah.
So.
Yeah, Texas was really tough. Access was almost impossible. Everything was private land stuff in it. And the only way you're getting on private lands is paying money. So
yeah, big bucks. I understand that. All right. So favorite gun to use while waterfowl hunting. Are you, let's say a semi-auto Beretta, or are you a Remington 870 pump kind of guy?
I am a semi-auto Winchester as a Winchester. What I've been shooting for a long
time. That's your one and only, huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that. So you shot a monster buck, what was it, last year?
Yeah, this last fall.
This thing is huge. We'll share a picture of it for sure. So when it comes to deer season, are you archery hunting or rifle hunting?
I'm whatever is available. I'm mostly focused on archery. Is my passion, but I'm not above going out if I need to and shooting one with a rifle. So.
Yeah,
I enjoy the archery season because I get to spend more time. Usually, I spend a lot more time outdoors, so I like it that way.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that. So what season do you look forward to the most, waterfowl or deer?
Waterfowl. I'm still real passionate about waterfowl hunting. So I specifically, I like teal season is my favorite anymore. And then closely followed, I really like to field hunt geese is my other passion. So.
Awesome. Okay. So here's a little switch. You're at Milford Lake. Are you blue cat fishing or are you crappie fishing?
Probably blue cats.
Yeah.
Blue cats. Yeah. I'm more of the cat fishing type, but I like, again, I'm an all around outdoorsman. I consider myself. So I like to vary a little bit, but probably going to go after blue cats. Yeah.
I mean, I feel like you have to at Milford, right?
Yeah.
All right. So I feel like I've seen you post some pictures turkey hunting. So do you prefer turkey hunting in Texas or Kansas?
I will have to say that I like Kansas opportunities. I had probably one of the best turkey hunts that may have ever been recorded in the face of turkey hunting with a good friend of mine that's now passed away. We were down there, you're able to shoot 4 toms during the spring, or at least when I was down there, and we each tagged out, each tagged 4 toms. We hunted a total of 3 hours.
Wow.
And tagged 4 toms apiece. So 8 toms in 3 hours of hunting. That was over 2 days. We quit after the first day. We had 4 apiece or 2 apiece, and we quit and left gobbling birds to come back the next day and do the same exact thing. So Texas was pretty good for that, at least that spot that I was able to hunt on.
Yeah, that's pretty special. Hard to replace that memory. Okay, so you're processing your deer you harvest. Are you making jerky or sausage? What's your favorite?
Sausage.
Okay.
Yeah, we all my family hunts too. So every year we get together at the end of the season and kind of compile a bunch of our meat, and we make several hundred pounds of sausage.
That's the way to do it.
Out within our family. Yep.
That's the way to do it. That's fantastic. Family affairs, even better. So this is that plays into my last one here. What gets you most excited, mentoring a new onset hunter or taking your kids out?
I really enjoy taking my kids out, whether it be hunting and fishing or just we live next to a creek. So we, like to go out for walks and stuff in the evenings and just show them the different tracks of wildlife and seeing the different wildlife. I really enjoy taking the family out and doing that type of stuff. So
yeah,
as much as we have time available to you.
Yeah. Well, you did pretty dang good there, Jason. You weren't too nervous.
No, I'm getting used to them. So
I should have made you work a little harder, I guess.
Well, Jason, what's the best way for people to, if you want them to connect with you, whether that's on social media or connect with the office there, or if they just want to check, what are the water levels? What's the bird report? I know, if it gets in December, January, it could be 50 degrees and lots of open water, or it could be a giant ice block and there's no birds, right? So, what would you recommend to people to either, connect with you or to find out more about the bottoms?
Obviously the first place I would go to is the website, our waterfowl reports. I try to update that as much, at least once a week I'll update it.
That's the department's website, right? And the bottoms doesn't have their own website.
Well, yeah, we have a sub page within the department's website. Yeah, they have the waterfowl report. I don't have a specific independent page from that, but the waterfowl report, we update that as much as we possibly can, or if conditions change. So I've mentioned whooping cranes out here before. Those show up. We close the pool to hunting. I post that on there. All the water levels, if conditions change, the ice conditions, I update that as much as see fit. Now, some people might not think I pay much attention to that, but I do. I'm pretty strict about making sure that that's updated if the conditions do change. The other thing we do, we also have on our office phone line, we have 2 phone lines. You can call either one of those and go to a recording that I also update as well. So I try to give as much information as possible on that recording. It's basically, a lot of it's the same type of information on that recording as we have on our website as well. So try to stay in tune that way. as far as social media, I don't have a huge social media presence or anything like that. We don't have a Facebook page or anything like that. But like I said, the best way to contact it on our office phone number, you can call there. You can leave a message, and I will return your phone call in as timely a manner as possible. So that's usually the way most a lot of people contact us is through the phone system. So
yeah. Well, Jason, we sure appreciate you coming on. You know, Brett and I were talking about guests and thinking about September and teal season coming open. And we knew there were some issues with drought going on out there at the property. And so we just wanted to have you on and talk about that. And always like to try and close out our episodes and encourage folks that to get out, get involved. You know, September's this month. Go check out the article at GreatPlainsOutdoors.com about the month of September, and then get involved with an NGO, whether that's Delta Waterfowl or Ducks Unlimited or Pheasants Forever, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers. All those groups do great work, and there's one out there that's a fit, and you get out and make a difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Jason, thanks for all you do for our public lands. We appreciate you.
Thank you. I want to tell one really quick story. People were just talking about our water levels. 2018, on Labor Day weekend, I left on Friday of 2018, Labor Day weekend, and it looked like we weren't going to have any kind of a duck season. We had very minimal water, only water in one pool and hardly any water in our storage pools. It didn't look like we were going to be able to flood any of our printer pools. I came back on Tuesday after Labor Day weekend, and the whole place was full. So it could happen that quick. Yeah. So it can happen. So
yeah. Well, there's a
don't lose hope. And if it does happen, I will update the waterfowl report and our phone message. So.
Perfect.
Well, thanks for sharing that, Jason. Hang in there, everybody, and keep your eyes peeled and pray for some rain. And just tune in next time as we welcome a new guest on board. And happy soon to be hunting, everybody.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.